It's the Philosopher's Zone, here on RN. Today, Alain Badiou on love and the revolution.
Love is the fundamental experience of the relationship to the other. Because in love, we must accept that the existence of something different is entirely in your existence. Sometimes I say that love is the minimal communism.
A radical on a classical theme, Alain Badiou has tackled the biggest of questions, but not just from his armchair. Nearing 80, he remains committed to political change, defending ideas which in practice have failed, in some instances savagely so. He's in Australia for masterclasses and public lectures, and he came to talk to us too. To set the scene is Paris-based Australian scholar Oliver Feltham, who's translated Badiou's work, including his classic Being and Event.
So he's probably one of the most well-known French philosophers alive today. And he's known particularly for the close relationship between his philosophy and political activism, though this is not one of the only attractions for his philosophy, of course. I came across his work when I was actually researching a paper on television and the events as an undergraduate. I had learned just enough French to put the French word for event into the database. And this book popped up. I went down into the stack, pulled it out. It was very thick. I could just work out it meant being an event. Looked fascinating. Flipped through the pages and saw lots of mathematics and just thought, this is not for me. Maybe some other time, and put it back in the shelves. And then when I actually went to Paris to do my PhD, I hooked up with another Australian postgraduate who was working there. And I'd already knew where Derrida was giving his classes, and I was attending those assiduously. And she said, look, you have to check out this other philosopher, Alain Badiou. He's far more radical. There are far younger people going along. It's much more interesting. This is really where you should go with your interests. So I turned up, and here was this guy wearing a flannelette shirt, a cardi, smoking Gaulois Bleu furiously as soon as he finished his lecture. And people were handing out political pamphlets in the actual lecture. There was far more noise and life in these big lectures that Badiou was doing.
So to the question of his radicalism, what do we mean by radical?
He is most definitely a Marxist. And in particular, his understanding of politics was formed by a kind of botched event, which was May 68. I mean, he was already politically active. He was protesting against the Algerian War. He was running with his comrades down the Boulevard Saint-Michel and getting beaten by the police with their long batons. So he was no stranger to political activism, and his father had also been active in the resistance as well. So that was part of his family history. But when May 68 happens, he suddenly saw a necessity to open up his own philosophy and to change the relationship in between philosophy and what was actually happening on the streets.
The May events, as they were called, during a four-week revolutionary outburst in France, shook the world by their ferocity and by the fact that they took place in one of the world's most civilized capitals.
Alain, welcome to Australia. You're giving a lecture titled Considerations on the World Situation. What will you be saying?
I think the question of the situation of the world today is a very complex and difficult question. It's because a long historical sequence is finished now. It has been the hand of the socialist states, the hand of the idea of communism as a really vivid idea, and all that is finished. And so the question is now, what are really the great contradictions in the contemporary world, if this contradiction is not between socialist states and the capitalist world, free world against totalitarianism and so on. And so my idea is to propose a vision, a structure, in some sense, of the contemporary world.
And what are those contradictions, if there are any, that can be used as a way for change? What do you see those contradictions as being?
Before saying all that, it's probably a necessity to clearly understand the dominant ideology today. The dominant ideology is that there is no real contradiction in some sense. All these contradictions are inside the same representation. And the dominant ideology is that there is only one world today. There is no two different worlds. There is no two different orientations. There is one world, and inside this unique world, we have some differences, but not central contradictions. Against all that, I propose to say that the contemporary world is organized around two fundamental contradictions. Not one, it's important to, but two. The first one, which is a theoretical and abstract, in some sense, contradiction. On one side, capitalism and the liberal ideology, and on the other side, the different forms of socialism, communism, and so on, which were on the side of the idea that it is possible to organize the economy and the social determination without the domination of private property. Today, for historical reasons, the idea of communism is very weak, but at the theoretical level, it's true always that you have the possibility of something else than the dominant capitalism. And so the first contradiction at a sort of ideal level is the contradiction between capitalism and communism. Communism in its primitive sense is not the communism of Stalin and so on during the last century, but is the communism of Marx. But today there is a second very important contradiction, which I name the contradiction between modernity and tradition. Modernity and tradition is something different. For example, it seems to me that during all the existence of socialist states, communism has been in relationship not to modernity, but to tradition, precisely. The classical communism was finally in a sort of moral orthodoxy, aesthetic, conservative aesthetics, a taste for order, social order, discipline, and so on. The result of all that has been that the modernity has been entirely, practically, on the side of the capitalist world. And even today, we have this contradiction at a very big scale. To understand the world today, we must organize a sort of mixture of the two contradictions between capitalism and communism on one side, and the contradiction, which is very active and real today, between modernity and tradition.
Looking for contradictions in the way we live today. Alain Badiou, our guest today on The Philosopher's Zone, with helpful insight from Oliver Feltham of the American University of Paris.
He gave the first of two lectures that became his first best-selling book called The Concept of Model, and developed his own account of change in knowledge based on the mathematical theory of models. And he gave the first lecture, but he never gave the second lecture, because that's when May 68 happened. And when he publishes the book, he prefaces it with a short note in which he confesses to the sin of theoreticism. That was, he was too theoretical, he was too caught up in these mathematical subtleties and in being too clever, and he needed to pay more attention to the class struggle. And so that was a turning point for him, and that's when he went into what I call his Maoist phase, which lasted all the way through the 70s. And during that period, yes, he very much identified as a Marxist. He rethought and reworked the classic terms of the Marxist dialectic, class struggle, class consciousness, ideology, this kind of thing, and published books on those terms. But what happened later was that in 1984, Jean-Luc Nancy and Philippe Le Coulibart invited him to this conference. And for him, this was a moment in which he very much felt he was coming in from the cold. He felt extremely isolated. He was not particularly happy that none of his work was being translated. In fact, nobody was really reading it. And in fact, he says, look, nobody knew what I was doing. I was completely isolated. And at one point he says, I was the only, you know, proletarian in the world of philosophy. But all of that seemed to change relations thawed in the early 80s. And Nancy and Le Coulibart said, come along to this conference called The Withdrawal of the Political and give a paper. And that became his book, Can Politics Be Thought? And in that, he ditches the Marxist vocabulary. And that's when he starts to talk about the event, faithfulness to an event.
So what is the event? What is the importance of the event?
The basic hypothesis is that when people engage in politics, they presume, at least, that they know what they're doing. There are a series of knowledges about what's possible in this political system, which way can a vote go given the composition of the Senate, how is society composed, are these people giving us trouble at the moment, are the middle classes happy, what's the effect of unemployment upon the popularity ratings of the Prime Minister, etc., etc. A whole series of things that we know. And those things form the framework within which we can act. So we only have a limited series of actions that we can perform without facing the risk of all the capital leaving the country immediately, this kind of thing. An event is basically something that just resets the framework, that completely disrupts the framework. It happens outside the sphere of what we usually understand. So a people that don't usually speak up start speaking up. His classic example was the immigrant workers with no papers suddenly said, we want the right to vote. I mean, their status was more or less of guest workers at the time. And they said, no, you know, we contribute, we pay social security, we contribute to the economic growth of this country. Obviously, we're needed as a subcategory of the population, otherwise there'd be no jobs for us. We're not unemployed. So if we're being taxed, you know, if we're paying social security, then we deserve the right to vote as well. And that made absolutely no sense because these people had the status of guest workers at the time. Mm. So parts of the population that previously haven't spoken up, haven't claimed political rights, when they do, then that's a moment where you have an event. It's where something just flips, something doesn't work, there's some kind of dysfunction.
The question how to change the world is a very complex one. I think that when there is really a new proposition in the concrete world, there is always three dimensions and not one. There is first something like an idea. That is a strategic vision. A strategic vision which is common to all the actors of the situation. Today, it's precisely what does not exist. Because today, practically, everybody thinks that capitalism is here for many centuries. And so there is no strategic idea. But it's a necessity. For example, in the Arabic Spring in Occupy Wall Street, you have not a strategic idea. We have some negative conviction. We want something else and so on. But there is no clear and proposition which is common to all the actors of the movement. It's the first point. The second point is the movement as such. There is never, if we have not a collective movement, uprising, revolt, and so on. And so it's a component, but by itself, all that cannot change the situation in a real manner. And it is why we have the third necessity, which is in some sense the mediation between the two, the mediation between the strategic idea and the strength of the movement, and which is the question of organization. Which is the question of organization. And it's always the most obscure question in the field of politics. It's central, but it's a very difficult question, because it's the question of the relationship between action and thinking. And the relationship between action and thinking is the very heart of true politics. And organization is, theoretically, the place where Something like that is active, is real. It is why during one century the Leninist party has been dominant. It has been dominant because it has been victorious in Russia and so on. It was a proposition, a concrete proposition concerning the relationship between theory and practice, between the strategic ideas and the tactic of revolution. And now this paradigm is out, and so we must invent a new paradigm, that is a new conception of organization, which is in some sense less military, less under the law of strict discipline, centralization, and so on, which is much more near the movement. But to be near the movement is not to be confusing with the movement. The political organization cannot disappear in the movement. We know that. We know also that if the organization is without the movement, finally, the organization and the state are the same thing. It's the history of socialist state. So we have the state, we have the movement, we have the strategic idea, and we have the political organization. That is our problem. But if I have a solution to this problem, I shall give you immediately. I have not.
Love, that's an interesting one. He's written recently a small but very, very intense and interesting book on love. What's his understanding or his attitude to the interpersonal in that regard?
So his argument is that there's an initial encounter which upsets our understanding of who we can be for other people, of what friendship means, of what it means to have a sexual relationship with a partner. All of those understandings that we have, all of those habits, those fantasies and so on, are disrupted by the encounter with the beloved. And the beloved immediately, it's not just an affair of desire, it's also an affair of thinking. You need to think about how you relate to your family. I mean, if you're really in love with somebody and you hit those early obstacles, which are, you know, he or she doesn't like your friends, or he or she finds it hard to get on with your family, or he or she thinks that you've got too much of a problem with your family and you need to get over it, you need to start thinking about how you relate to other people, whether they're right or wrong. Start retelling your own story to yourself. And so that's the disruption. That's the event, the encounter. But then what's really important, what I wanted to talk about earlier, is fidelity. What a fidelity is basically teasing out the consequence of that love. So if you are in love with that person, what does that mean in terms of how you make your choices? What does that mean in terms of what kind of work you do, how you relate to your family, how you socialize? Are you listening to them? Is there a new kind of understanding of who you can be that's emerging from the couple? And you can either decide to tease out those consequences, or you can draw a boundary and say, listen, love, you know, you're wonderful, but let's just leave these things at home. And when it comes to my mates, I'll do what I want. I'll continue to go out on a Friday night, and that's it. So at that point, you've absolutely failed to tease the consequences of that event into that area of your life. You're drawing an artificial boundary. And so in a certain sense, the signification of the love is reduced, right? And you can imagine the reaction to that kind of declaration. So teasing out the consequences in an eminently practical way, figuring out what it means to be a human being, you know, in ethical terms, if this person has this love for you, if there's this love between us. And at one point, you know, he's very down to earth. He says, look, a fidelity in the end is just an arrangement whereby you work out how to get through disagreements. Okay, so it's not a particularly romantic conception of love. But for me, it's a very down to earth one. It's just you need to know, how is it that you're going to be able to resolve disagreements? Because, you know, there will be disagreements. You need to work out how to get through them.
Love is the fundamental experience for everybody, in some sense, of the relationship to the other. Because in love, we must accept that the existence of something different is entirely in your existence. Sometimes I say that love is the minimal communism, the smallest communism, the communism with two individuals, because there is something in love which must be not only the world as experienced by one individual, but the world as it is seen by the two, is the creation of the source, that sort of minimal community, which is a community of the two. But I think also that love is also something dangerous, something which sometimes is in the nature of sacrifice of individual process for the other. But precisely, the question is the question of a new love. We must invent love. That love is not something that we know completely, but that we must create a new love. And I think that to create a new love is a part of our fundamental search of today, which is a new modernity. And a new modernity is also a new love.
My gut reaction to that is that it's a rather conservative formulation from someone who's quite radical. It sort of tells the story in a very kind of reasonable, let's say, way.
Well, I think, to be radical, one has to be entirely reasonable. I mean, to be radical is to want to affect some kind of transformation of the whole. And if you're going to do that, you need to be incredibly practical. Otherwise, you're not going to get anywhere. It's certainly a far cry from some of the work on sexual identity, the performance of gender, that kind of thing. But one has to be aware that Badiou was a very close reader of Lacan's work and has a very deep engagement with Lacan's contention that there is no sexual relationship or there is no sexual intercourse, that the two genders, and this is not determined biologically, just simply miss each other in the requirements they make of each other. And Badiou has a very long argument in which he argues that over that impossibility, over that difficulty of communication, a bridge can be built, but it's a practical bridge made up of everyday acts. It's not a particular kind of relationship that's set in stone. It's not a rule book. It's a series of acts whereby you achieve an understanding over time.
You talk about the mini-communism of the two, but is that also a reactionary idea, that notion of love?
You know, the question of the love is really the question of the primitive dialectical situation between a subject and the other. And love is a very active and intense part of this constitutive relationship to the other in the individual. And we must distinguish between this dialectic and all the social consequences and organizational models of all that. For example, family must be understood in many different significations. In some sense, the relationship between family and love is exactly the same as the relationship between the state power and politics. So, exactly like the state must be under the law of politics and not politics under the law of the state, love must be the law for family and not under the law of family. That is why the invention of a new love is also an invention of a new family.
On the mini-communism of two, philosopher, novelist and playwright Alain Badiou on the revolutionary power of love. You'll find a link on our site to the public lecture he gave recently in Melbourne, where he goes into some detail on the clash of big ideas that we touched on today and what it might portend. We also heard from Oliver Feltham, Paris-based Australian scholar who's translated a number of Badiou's works. He's at the American University of Paris. Production today by Diane Dean and Simon Branthwaite. I'm Joe Gelonesi. Hope to see you again next week on The Philosopher's Zone.
Health Report, immunising mothers-to-be. Did you know that the whooping cough vaccine doesn't last for life? So by the time a woman reaches childbearing, and indeed her extended family, they're all going to lack whooping cough immunity, which puts the newborn baby at serious risk. So can you immunise pregnant women safely? And does it protect the baby? Or are you better to cocoon the child in a newly immunised family? And that's just one of the stories on this week's Health Report. So why not download a podcast from RN's website?